Welcome back to the StratCom podcast. It's a true honor that today we have with us Professor Tosh Minohara. Professor Minohara is a professor of international relations and security studies at the Graduate School of Law and Politics of Kobe University, where he holds a joint appointment with the Graduate School of International Cooperation Studies. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
We are very excited to have a Japanese perspective on this podcast. We're a bit exhausted from Baltic issues, Central Eastern Europe, even the Euro-Atlantic space. So it's a true pleasure to have you here.
And I'll do my best to meet your expectations.
I have zero doubt. Maybe we can start with a kind of broader scene setter for our listeners. Amidst all of these geopolitical shifts, amidst this turbulence, amidst war, how does Japan see its place in the world? And is there a growing debate taking place regarding the country's pacifist constitution?
Yes. Well, there definitely is more awareness as to the changing dynamics of the security environment surrounding Japan. And it's, you know, I think what happened to Ukraine was the wake-up call. And it made most Japanese realize, hey, you know, this could be us. I mean, war could happen. It could be at our doorsteps. But unfortunately, over the year and a half, I believe the Japanese interest in the war in Ukraine itself is fading. You know, Japan is
among the public.
Yeah, because Japan is not like the Baltics. Even though it's strange, even though Japan neighbors Russia and Russia occupies its territory, the reality has not really sunk in. And again, I'm talking about the general public. Now, the Japanese security posture has changed drastically. He's now passed away, but Prime Minister Abe, and that was continued largely by current Prime Minister Kishida, and those are the so-called three documents on national security. So Japan's posture is moving very rapidly. The defense budget is increasing at an enormous rate, but yet the Japanese public really is not on board. They're not really aware of the drastic changes taking place. And without the public on board, I think it's very hard to change the Japanese constitution. And I believe, despite what Prime Minister Kishida is messaging, I don't think he would really take the step to revise Article 9. That's the so-called part of the peace constitution, because it is the most divisive domestic political issue that Japan has. So the moment he takes this issue, he's going to lose half the population supporting him. So if you're a politician, why do that? So at the end of the day, and I may sound very pessimistic, I think the Japanese constitution will only change if something drastic happens to Japan directly, whether it's losing Senkakus or it's the Taiwan Straits. Maybe the Taiwan Straits won't be enough. It has to be some kind of physical attack on Japan. It's the moment that Japan will react and revise the constitution. So, I mean, it's there, and it's a pretty stubborn constitution. And I think Japanese, the way they pursue security is much different than those in the Baltics. So I think to get some perspective.
But so why is the public interest fading? Why is public kind of engagement so low? Because in what Russia is doing in Ukraine, I mean, of course, it constitutes brutal violations of international law. Yes. Presumably, this would be of interest to Japan. It also constitutes a nuclear power attacking a country that willingly gave up its nuclear arsenal. These sorts of narratives not resonate with the Japanese public?
So again, I'm not saying that it doesn't resonate with, you know, with everybody. It's just, it's the majority, because the front lines remain stagnant until this recent offensive which supposedly just started last week. And because it was stagnant, it just sort of faded. Ukraine no longer became top news. You know, from February of last year, for at least probably good part of the year, it was there. You know, especially when Ukraine made that big push, and then it was something to report about. And after that, it just started fading. And the thing that the Russians are doing, I mean, this is a travesty. And I think Japan should be more aware and see it as part of them, you know. But it's just very difficult for many Japanese to wrap their heads around the fact that this is not separate. This is not an incident that's just affecting Ukrainians. It's all of us. And for that matter, this war, the way I see the war, it's a war in which Ukrainians are fighting for our values. And so that's why I totally support them. And this is why this is my necktie is, you know.
It's an excellent.
Yeah, thank you.
Excellent.
But, you know, I think this is a concept that's very hard to understand, comprehend for some Japanese. So why is it our war? You know, it's way out there. And the Russians aren't menacing us in any way. So, and I think the greater threat, unfortunately, is North Korea. And that's
not China.
China doesn't lob missiles at Japan. And so from the way I see it, I think China is the greater threat, but visibly because the frequency of the missile tests by North Korea and the fact that they have ICBMs now makes it more visible. And another thing is there's an alert called J Alert, and I think the J stands for Japan, so Japan Alert. And so our phones go off every time the North Koreans fire a missile. So we're sitting on a train and all our phones start beeping. And you look at the message, it's like the North Koreans have just fired a missile. So
something Ukrainians could certainly relate to.
And that's why that takes priority over China or what's happening in Ukraine. So, yeah.
But nevertheless, the response of the Japanese government to Russian aggression has been very principled. Japan has condemned Russia's actions in international fora. Japan has provided humanitarian financial assistance to Ukraine, has imposed some sanctions against Russia. And in response, Russia has labeled Japan an unfriendly country.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. It's a badge of honor.
So I'm wondering if there are any implications of that. Do you see Russia somehow kind of spreading disinformation targeting the Japanese society? Does Russia use any other levers to meddle in Japan's domestic affairs?
No, not specifically, not at a level that is noticeable, that has any visible impact. And personally, when I was at a symposium and I gave a talk, and after my talk, the Russian diplomat walked up to me. I didn't know he was Russian. Sticks out his hand, I shook it, and he says to me, and I had harsh words to say about Russia. He said, despite what you said, we are going to win this war. And he says, believe me, we are going to swallow and squash Ukraine. And so, I mean...
And what did you say to that?
I said, I don't see it happening. So, you know, I challenged him. I said, well, if that's what you're saying, then show me. Show me that Russia has the wherewithal and the might to do what you're saying. Because I don't think they necessarily do, not at this stage. And the reason why I was intentionally provocative is because, you know, people are going to take issues with what I'm going to say right now. And that is, I think we need to eliminate the Russian threat. And it shouldn't be, oh, Russia, you were bad this time. We're going to slap you on the hand. We need to take measures to weaken Russia so that it no longer will be a threat.
What kind of measures?
Russia's large. I would like to see smaller Russias. You know, I say I love Russia so much. I like to see many small Russias, you know, because it's just, or else it's going to be the same story over again. And by this, I am hoping that, and I'm going to sound awful, that Putin miscalculates and decides to escalate in the war in a matter in which we have to react. We can't just be sending lethal aid. It has to be much more, maybe boots on the ground. And this is the only way that I think we can eliminate this threat. Now, I've spoken to many people in the Baltics, you know, experts, and they always say to me, they tell me, so we talk about how this war can end up. And they say to me, and this is many people, they say the same thing, 1917. And I was thinking, 1917, well, that's when the United States entered the war. And I'm thinking, that's what I think is the, you know, decisive moment. When the United States decides, we got to send boots to this conflict, I think it's when Russia really loses. But that's not what they're thinking. 1917 is when Russia withdraws from the First World War. And they say that they believe that Russia's going to crumble internally. But, you know, I think that there's an error in that perception, and that is because the reason why Russia crumbled in 1917, or, you know, withdrew, is because they had already lost a major war, and that's the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 and 1905. So after that massive loss, here they are, you know, in a stalemate, and the public just had enough. But you look at Putin, 2008, Georgia, 2014, Crimea, he has success racked up. And so I think the situation is quite different. And I think Putin is not the czar back in the early part of the previous century. that he has much more control over the people and the military. And so I don't see this this end game of Russia crumbling. So we have to help it crumble, is what I'm thinking. Yeah.
So the way to bring about the end of an empire would be to make it lose an imperial war, as is waging.
But we can't go out swinging, right? So they have to, you know, hit us below the belt and make us angry. And that will change, I think, it will change American public opinion. So, for example, in the United States, many people think this war is an Ukrainian war. It's not an American war. That let the Ukrainians or the Europeans deal with it. And this, I think, understanding or perception has to change. And the only way to do that is for Russia to do something which changes public opinion in a drastic way. So if we're going back to the World War I analogy, it's something like Lusitania or the Zimmerman Telegram, something that really outrages Americans, and they see it as their own war. And so if Putin is careful, that's something that he doesn't want to do. But I think he's getting kind of desperate too, you know, because we are providing really, you know, some really powerful, potent hardware, military hardware, F-16s and these, you know, main battle tanks. So I think he's going to get frustrated. He's going to make that misstep, is what I'm counting on. Now, let me go back to Japan. Is Japan doing enough? I think Japan is doing more than Japan would have done maybe 10 years ago. But I don't think Japan should yet pat itself on the back.
Does Japan have red lines on lethal aid or such provision?
Yeah, I wouldn't say there are bright red lines. Maybe they're like, you know, pink lines in the sense that these are lines that Japan can cross, but don't want to cross. And even if they cross it, it's not the end of the day. And by this, I mean, Japan's providing trucks now and medical equipment and gas masks and, you know, bulletproof vests. And this is all great. But at the end of the day, Japan has really fine military hardware that it's no longer going to use. So if you're going to just toss it and you can't just throw things in the ocean anymore. It costs money to dismantle. Why not give it to the Russians? And specifically, I have two systems that Japan could provide to Ukraine. And one would be the MLRS, the multiple launch rocket system. Japan is now bringing in new ones. So the old ones are there. You know, why not give it to, and if you can't give it to the Ukrainians directly, give it to the Americans and say, Americans, can you get rid of this for us? And America will say, okay, we'll get rid of it and send it to Ukraine, right? And Japan is not complicit, at least not directly. And another thing is Japan has these really 40-year-old howitzers, and they're 203-millimeter howitzers. So they're huge. I mean, right now, the NATO standard is 155. And the Ukrainians know how to use these howitzers. Japan has, I believe, 24 of these, and they have lots of shells to go with it. So, you know, why not ship it off? And this is a step that Japan is not willing to take, but I think it needs to. You know, and I think, you know, Macron making comments like, oh, you know, I don't think we can allow Japan to be a NATO partner. We don't need that Tokyo office. But this would sort of dispel such comments. If Japan were to do more in support of this war in Europe, European countries, including France, will say, well, we need Japan in our corner. This country makes a difference. After all, Japan's GDP is larger than
Japan is the third economy in the world, no?
Yeah. Right. I think Germany's catching up, but yeah, by my last count, it was number three, yes. Mm-hmm.
But so is this kind of restraint or lack of political will, is it due to fear of some sort of retaliation by Russia? Or is it just a kind of a culture of restraint, of not contributing to some sort of...
I think Japan has really regretted or regressed what it has done in the past. Now, I'm talking about the 1930s. And many Japanese fear of this resurgence of Japan being a militaristic expansionist power, where the reality is it's the opposite. The world is not afraid of a militaristic Japan. They're afraid of Japan that does nothing, right? That stands idly by. And you got to pull your weight. And so, but it's, you know, why is this so ingrained in Japan? I think it's the education system, where it's always about peace, 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 no military. Japan lives in this peace bubble. And people take peace for granted. And the way I see it, they treat it like it's air. You know, you and I, we can't live without air, right? But do we wake up and say, oh, air, thank you for being around today? We don't, right? We just take it for granted. But I think that's how the Japanese people take peace. That peace is not something to be created. It's something that's just there. And so why even think about it? So I think the psyche is completely different than, for example, Europe or even North America or even, you know, Australia and New Zealand for that matter. It's just because Japan was the aggressor during the Second World War. And I think that you can relate to Germany. Germany was initially very timid, right? Very slow. And then the presidential said, Chancellor Schultz, thank you. He says, we understand that this is our war. And I think that was, no, he said that, right? And I think this was a pivotal moment for Germany. But Japan is not yet at that stage because the war is not at its doorsteps.
You mentioned this feeling of regret. And of course, Japan, well, alongside Germany, are the two absolute exemplary models of how a nation can transform from an empire, from, as you said, the aggressor, to really an exemplary democracy, a civilian, humanitarian, superpower, champion of international law. Do you think there are any lessons we can take from Japan's experience on how to kind of break this imperial syndrome? Because that is, at the core of what we're facing today with Russia.
That's actually a question that was asked during the war in Iraq. You know, that can Iraq be rebuilt like Germany and Japan was after the war? You know, because, and it didn't work out. You know, Japan was occupied, Germany was occupied, and Iraq was occupied, but the outcome was completely different. And I think the reason is, I mean, there are many reasons, but one reason is because both Japan and Germany had a period of democracy. There are people who understood the concept, understood its importance, and it was a matter of bringing back these responsible leaders. And I don't think Iraq has that. Now, Russia, were they ever a pure democracy? And, you know,
maybe in the 90s.
A little bit, right? But when you look at their history, they don't have a period where I don't think democracy had the time to grow solid roots. And therefore, you can't make the comparison. Russia is completely different. And Russia, along with China, believe two things. One is that they have a very strong sense of being a victim, that things are stacked against them, it's unfair, and they need to reverse that. And the other thing is that they have a very enlarged sense of greatness, that they want to be a great power once again. And these are things that Japan and Germany don't have. You know, they don't see themselves as being great. No, they actually, in Japan's case, they underestimate their own strength. You know, most Japanese don't think, you know, it's funny because I talk to my students, they're like, Japan is a small power, you know, and I'm like, no, I think a lot of Europeans would debate that.
I don't think anybody in Europe would say Japan is a small power.
But so this is the what do you call it, the misperception or the perception gap that most Japanese see themselves as a small island nation. And it's not true, because when you look at
G7, large.
But when you look at the maritime area that Japan has, Japan becomes number six in the world. But it's just, it doesn't really resonate with most Japanese that they are. You know, they see themselves, because you know, Japan had 30 years of economic deflation. So they used to see themselves as being wealthy, but now the yen is so weak and we travel to Europe and we can't buy anything. And so this is the new Japan. So they're losing confidence in that front as well as an economic power, even though, like you said, they're still number three. But if you're number three, I think you have to act like you're number three and try to make a larger difference. And I think this is a challenge for Japan. Because if Japan really helps out Ukraine, provides lethal aid, I mean, really be there as Ukraine's partner, you know, non-European partner, then if something happens to Japan in East Asia, you know, I bet you the Ukrainians will come and support Japan. This is how strong friendships are created.
I saw that Ukraine, even the Ukrainian parliament, the Verkhovna Rada, even passed a resolution on the occupied territories of Japan. Condemning the Russian mm-hmm. presence there. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly a solidarity.
Yeah.
There.
So I think it's a brotherhood, but Japan has to play that brotherly role. I mean, when you know, for Ukraine is fighting a war of its own existence, and Japan has to understand that it needs to back up Ukraine and allow it to survive. And I feel it to be a mission that Japan needs to take on. But again, there's a wide gap within the public as how to perceive this war. So
I want to return to a topic that you brought up about relations between NATO and Japan. There are some news about this announcement about opening of a NATO office, a representation in Japan. And then there were immediately some grumblings that actually NATO is maybe not completely united on this.
By one leader, right? In Europe.
President Macron
that's right.
said that NATO has no business being in Asia, that the mandate is just
the charter doesn't carry. Call it. Yeah.
What do you think about this?
I think it's a bunch of nonsense. And that's actually really goes back to what, you know, in the session that I was in earlier, I said, you know, Europe and Asia are linked. You can't de-link the two. I mean, we live in the small planet and they're all connected. So what happens in Russia influences Asia. What happens in Asia influences Russia. So I think, I would hope a country like France and a leader of such a fine country would have a greater vision and see the big picture, you know. And, you know, it's not like Japan is saying they're going to be a member of NATO. They just want to work closer with NATO. What's the harm in that? And so I think Macron is very much about Europe for Europeans. I mean, and the thing that's so sad about his comment is that it comes at the heels of, you know, he went to Beijing, he met Xi Jinping, and he said, you know, we're not going to let the United States push us around. And it's like, is that the messaging that you want to, you know, send out to the world? That France is not on board? But, you know, how much of that is Macron and how much of that is the French people speaking? Right, so that's the distinction I don't know, but it is unfortunate because in one of the sessions today, you know, earlier, that was yesterday, saying that unity was important among Europeans, but this is discord. It's not unity.
And where can NATO and Japan work together more closely? Do you have any particular domains or any particular issues in mind?
Well, one that's very obvious is cyber. Mm-hmm. Cyberspace, and I think Japan is working to work closely with NATO on that. Japan also can work, obviously, on intelligence sharing. And the other facet relates to the Center of Excellence here in Riga at the Strategic Communication. Now, Japan does not yet divide strategic communication with its public diplomacy, but here in Europe, that's divided. And so these are things that Japan can learn, that, okay, we need to separate our public diplomacy arm from our strategic communication arm. So for Japan, there is a learning curve, but, you know, you have the expertise, and this is where Japan could really soak up and absorb the knowledge that you have, so that Japan could be, a very effective and hopefully potent counterpart in Asia of NATO. So don't see as Japan being NATO-fied, it's NATO gaining a very strong and dependable partner in East Asia. So, yeah.
Maybe one final question.
Okay.
There is a lot of hand-wringing among pundits and analysts, I'm sure even people at this event, about tensions in Taiwan. Some even kind of already employing this apocalyptic narrative that will be the next war after Ukraine. What is the perspective from Japan? Is this the most kind of pressing geopolitical priority, the most pressing point of tension?
Yes and no. Again, it's yes for the government, it's yes for those who understand security, and it's probably no for those who don't pay attention to such things. So again, I think there needs to be, if Japan is going to communicate with its people, that people understand that the fate of Taiwan is intertwined with Japan's fate.
How so?
Because, I guess a good example for if you have a Baltics audience, okay, you're Latvia, what happens if Lithuania becomes Russian, right? And that's just the same thing. Taiwan borders Japan. I mean, Okinawa, for one of the islands in Okinawa, that's one of these islands in the southwest, you can actually see Taiwan. So if Taiwan becomes part of China, that changes the security realities of Japan. It's to the detriment. And so that can't happen. But I don't think most people or vast majority of people do not make that connection, that what happens in Taiwan impacts us. And I always think that retaking an island is much more costly than defending it initially. So we can't afford to lose Taiwan. And the other question is, of course, Senkakus, which we haven't talked about. These are the inhabited islands that are Japanese possession, which China says no. So, you know, China may test the waters and decide, okay, these islands are unprotected. Let's take it. Let's see how the United States reacts. And the United States has publicly claimed that it's part of the U.S.-Japan alliance, that America will defend these islands. But I don't see it that way. It's one thing to message that. It's another thing to convince your people that to protect an island that the Japanese themselves are not protecting, that would be a hard sell for most Americans, I think. So that's the thing. If I can say one more thing, that is that at the end of the day, Japan, and foremost Japan, needs to be responsible for its own security. And I think Latvians understand that, right? You may have Canadian
A couple wake-up calls.
So you can't just depend on an alliance. You can't just depend on your partners. Or look at the Ukrainians. You know, in the initial, you know, first 2 months, it was all Ukrainian, right? I mean, then we start seeing Stingers and Javelins, but they had to put up the fight before we came out in support. So the initial couple months, couple weeks.
And final question.
Okay. I thought that was
a very apocalyptic note.
Okay.
But in your view, can great power war be averted?
That's a really good question, and I think the answer has to be yes. Now, we are on a collision course right now, but, you know, what happens is in these authoritarian regimes, you know, power is vested in one person. And these persons, as far as I know, they're human beings. They're mortal. So something can happen, right? Who knows? Maybe they step on a banana peel and they slip and fall and they break their neck or something happens, right? That, I think, is one thing that we can expect, that something happens internally and they have another leader or the chaos ensues domestically, they look inwards. But other than that, I think China, you know, I'm not an expert on Russia, so I'm going to talk about China. China is on a path. They are determined to challenge the West. You know, it's because, you know, that's the sense of greatness. They want, because ever since the Opium Wars, they've been treated poorly by the West. Now, they've been like doormats, and so they want to return to greatness, and they don't want to be America's junior partner. So yeah, I think as long as Xi Jinping's around, I mean, we should take his rhetoric seriously. He says the rise of the Han people, you know, strong, great China, and I think he means it. And so he's a man on a mission, and he has an objective. Where are we in the West? Do we have a mission? Do we have an objective? Now, he has these goalposts, and he's driving towards that. So this is something, so do we accommodate that? Or are we doing it? And I think it's increasingly becoming more difficult to accommodate his goal, his national goal. So again, you wanted me to end on a positive note. Here I am going back. So yeah, but we should never give up. That's my thing. We should never give up on diplomacy, and war should not be a solution that we choose.
Well, Professor Inohara, this was truly an enlightening conversation. You brought something completely different to our podcast, and I really appreciate it.
Okay, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us.